Hi folks. Before I get into this episode, I want to again thank my Patreons for their continuing support. If you've been enjoying this podcast and would like to support it, then you can do so over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. There you can donate the price of a coffee or pint to help continually improve this podcast. Alternatively, if you want to support the podcast without donating, you can leave a review on whatever app you listen to your podcasts on. It all helps. We're coming close to the end of the first season now, and I'm already starting to plan new episodes for the second season. And as well as that, I'm starting to look into doing interviews with people who've lived through this time. So there will be a lot more coming in the near future. That's all from me. Now back to the episode. It was the 27th of December 1973 when there was a knock on the door of the Niedermeyer residence. It was late at night, and 16-year-old Renata answered the door. There were two men at the door who asked to speak to her father, as they had hit his car with theirs. She went upstairs and woke her father up. He walked out his front door and was never seen alive again. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. Before I start, I just want to give a heads up that this episode is quite heavy, and in particular towards the end of the episode, there are many references to suicide. So please take care, and if this is something that you may be sensitive to, then I'd advise giving this episode a miss. In the early 1960s, the Northern Irish government successfully managed to convince a number of large German companies to open manufacturing plants in Northern Ireland. The largest company to come over was Grundig, who manufactured reel-to-reel tape recorders and dictation machines. They are these small recorders with two circular tape reels at the top. Grundig employed 1,500 Northern Irish people in the townland of Dunmurry, which is between Belfast and Lisburn. There were also plans to open up another factory in the Northern Irish town of Newry, but these plans were eventually abandoned. Thomas Niedermeyer was a German man who was the managing director of the Grundig factory. He moved over to Northern Ireland in 1961 with his wife, Ingeborg, and two daughters, Gabriella and Renata. In 1971, he was appointed the title of Honorary German Consul in Northern Ireland, which meant that he would look after the affairs of Germans in Belfast, but it was slightly less official than a career diplomat. Thomas's wife, Ingeborg, grew up in what was known as East Prussia, which today would be known as Poland or Russia. She would have been a teenager in 1945 when the Russian Red Army invaded Nazi Germany. They severed all road and railway links, effectively cutting East Prussia off from the rest of the world. The Russian soldiers also had a bad reputation of raping and killing Prussian women, and Ingeborg was one of the many refugees who fled this region to get away from the soldiers during the freezing winter of 1945. She made her way over to Bavaria, where she met and married Thomas Niedermeyer. This traumatic upbringing left its imprint on Ingeborg, and living in Northern Ireland at the onset of the Troubles didn't help either. She soon began to heavily rely on the support of her husband. Just a quick note, I'll be referring to Mr. Niedermeyer as Herr Niedermeyer for the rest of this episode. Herr is the German word for Mr., and it was how he was referred to at the time. As a boss, Herr Niedermeyer was known to be fair but also heavy-handed. One of his colleagues described him as having, quote, a typical German's capacity for endless work. He didn't allow any sectarian symbols or images on the factory floor and wanted to keep the politics of the time out of the workplace. A former employee of the factory said that he was an excellent foreman and that his knowledge was second to none. He went on to say, quote, he could be bad-tempered and fly into a rage, but I never knew if that was just part of an act. The time I spoke to him just days before he died, he was very friendly. Another worker at the factory recalls the last time he saw Herr Niedermeyer. On the last day before the factory closed for Christmas, they asked if anybody wanted to stay to 7 p.m. and get paid overtime, even though we weren't doing any work, so I said I would. I was sitting at the bench, having a bottle of stout, when Mr. Niedermeyer came along and sat down and had a chat with me. I remember him being very humorous, very nice and friendly. Brian Keenan was a member of the Provisional IRA who worked at the Grundig factory. While there, he became a trade union official and would often have heated meetings with Niedermeyer. Some accounts say that he hated him, perhaps because he was a symbol of a capitalist society, of which the IRA was firmly against. In 1973, Keenan left Grundig to devote his time fully to work in the IRA, and he gradually became a leading figure in the group. In Northern Ireland, he would plan many bombing attacks, and he would also go overseas and arrange arms smuggling into Northern Ireland. In the early 70s in Northern Ireland, the IRA had a constant stream of bomb plots and car bombs going off. As well as that, the Loyalists had expanded their attacks into the Republic of Ireland, like we saw in the previous episode. 1973 saw the first referendum occurring in Northern Ireland, which was known as the Border Poll. Nationalists were completely against this poll and boycotted it, while other groups referred to it as a sectarianism headcount. To protest against this, the IRA launched their first attack into mainland Britain, in the form of the 1973 Old Bailey bombing. Four bombs were planted in London, two of which exploded and caused a large amount of damage, but no direct deaths, though one man died of a heart attack shortly after the bombing. 10 IRA members were arrested while trying to leave England, including Dolores Price and her sister Marion. They were sentenced to 20 years in a British prison. Keenan wanted to help the sisters, so the idea of kidnapping someone of importance grew in his head. He chose his former employer, Herr Nademeyer, and was planning to hold him ransom until the British government transferred the Price sisters from mainland Britain to a Northern Irish prison. As a foreigner, Herr Nademeyer believed that he was safe from the sectarian violence that was going on in Northern Ireland at the time. Unfortunately, his status was actually the reason for his kidnap, as the IRA believed that Britain would lobby to have him back safely so as to preserve their diplomatic relationship with Germany. On the 27th of December, the plan to kidnap Thomas Nademeyer was put into motion, and the lives of the entire Nademeyer family would never be the same again. It was 11:15 at night when there was a knock on the door of the Nademeyer residence. Ingeborg was in the hospital at the time, so it was just Herr Nademeyer, 19-year-old Gabriella, and 16-year-old Renata. Renata answered the door to two men asking to speak to her father. They explained that there had been an accident, and Herr Nademeyer's car, which was parked in the street, had been damaged. Renata woke her father up, who went outside with the men to inspect the damage to his car. A neighbour living in the house opposite to the Nademeyer residence described what happened next. There was a car parked outside of Thomas's house with its brake lights on. Herr Nademeyer and the men examined his car, then talked for a few minutes. Then, when Herr Nademeyer tried to return to his house, he was grabbed and bundled into the boot of the car before being driven off. This was the last time he was ever seen alive. One day after his disappearance, stewards from the Grundig factory released a statement saying that Grundig factory was a model factory, and Catholics and Protestants worked side by side with each other on the basis of equality. They called on all trade unions to join them in condemning the callous act of kidnap. By this stage, they were completely unaware that the kidnap had been orchestrated by one of their own. Here's a clip of young Gabriella talking about finding her father.
We just don't know what's happened. The police haven't been able to find anything. We've got to do something.
There was also the lie that it was in some way a personal matter. There was some personal grudge involved.
There's nothing there at all. My father didn't have any enemies over here or in Germany. And he was always said to be a very fair man. So there wasn't anything in the personal way to cause this.
Can you give me some impression of what life is like for yourself and your family and your mother?
Well, it's not very easy. My sister and I find it hard. During the day, she goes to school and I go to college. People know us. And, you know, you find people pointing to you. My mother is even worse off because she's instantly recognised. And, well, apart from that, you know, sitting in the evening watching television, it's just empty because usually my father was with us and now he's not.
Do you listen to news broadcasts?
Yes. Ever? More often than before.
What are you hoping for there?
Well, somebody would say something. Somebody finally decide that there's no point in just keeping quiet.
You were very close to your father, were you?
We all were. We were quite, you know, very close family.
You would prefer to know, would you?
Yes.
Would that, in a sense, be something of a relief?
It would be a relief to know that my father is dead or that he is alive, one way or the other.
What do you think?
Well, I firmly believe that he is alive. And until somebody can prove to me he's not, I'll continue to believe that.
Gabrielle, it's just possible that there may never be an explanation, putting it at its worst. How much do you fear that?
I think it's the worst thing that could happen.
In the immediate aftermath of the kidnapping, there was radio silence. No demands, nothing. The kidnapping became somewhat of a press storm, and the Niedermeyer family were quickly overwhelmed by the rumours appearing in the papers. There were some wild claims that made it into print, one saying that he was killed by international arms traffickers, or that he was killed by a jealous boyfriend. Ingeborg received letters saying that he had run off with another woman, and even a clairvoyant visited the home for a period of time. Here's a clip of Ingeborg speaking with a German reporter where she dismissed all this speculation.
Mrs. Niedermeyer, have you got ever any information by the British or German government about the demand the kidnappers has done already 2 days after the kidnapping?
No, I have never heard anything about it.
What is your opinion? Shouldn't you have one of this information?
I suppose I should have had some information.
Before the release was made by the Home Secretary, there were a lot of speculations about private or business reasons of the kidnapping.
Well, that has to stop now. There is no private or business behind it.
I see. Mrs. Niedermeyer, what is your feeling at the moment? Is your husband dead or alive?
My feeling is he is alive.
Time started to pass, and Ingeborg, Renata and Gabriella made some impassioned pleas on national television, imploring Herr Niedermeyer's captors to release him. The German government offered a sizable sum of money for any information, but nothing came. Ingeborg ended up speaking on the national broadcaster to appeal for information about her husband.
I like to make my last and final appeal to the people who took my husband, asked for anything. If my husband is alive, they could ask for anything. They would get it. And if my husband is dead, why don't they tell me? It's so hard to live with not knowing. You live from day to day. You wait and you give up hope. And then after a few days, I have still hope that goes up and down. It's so hard.
At this time, the British government denied that the IRA had made contact with them at all. But many years later, it emerged that the IRA had contacted them to negotiate the transfer of the Price sisters in exchange for Herr Niedermeyer. The two parties briefly engaged in communication before the IRA abruptly ceased contact and went dark. 7 months later, it was July 1974, and after following up to 440 separate leads, officers were getting nowhere in the investigation, and it was gradually wound down. Ingeborg had petitioned the German government to get a widow's pension and had a gravestone erected in a nearby church so that she had something to visit, even if there was nobody there. Less than a year after her father's disappearance, the older of the sisters, Gabriella, married a British RAF pilot in England and moved away. Ingeborg and Renata remained in Northern Ireland as Renata was still in school. Alan Simpson was an RUC officer who went on to write a book about his experiences working in Northern Ireland. The book is called Duplicity and Deception, and in the book he explains the breakthrough that finally gave the officers a tangible lead in the case of Herr Niedermeyer. It was 1979, 7 years after Niedermeyer's initial disappearance. Simpson had managed to gain the trust of an IRA member known only as Disciple, who revealed a number of things about the inner workings of the IRA. One of which was in relation to the kidnapping of Herr Niedermeyer. Firstly, Disciple revealed that he was dead and that something had gone wrong early on in the kidnapping, but he wasn't sure what. Secondly, Disciple had overheard two IRA members talking about it in a pub, saying that they had buried Niedermayer face down so he could, quote, dig himself in deeper. He then went on to say that Herr Niedermayer was buried in Colin Glen. Colin Glen is a beautiful wooded valley, which is very close to Herr Niedermayer's home. In fact, Ingeborg had passed by this very area many times. The IRA had supposedly buried him there, and then paid off local builders to use the site as a rubbish dump. So over the 7 years, tons of rubbish had amassed on the site, which stretched about 300 metres in length. It would be a mammoth undertaking to try and find his body. As well as that, any sort of operation would alert the IRA, which could provoke violence, which the RUC didn't want. To combat this, a fictitious environmental agency called the West Belfast Environmental Action Group was set up with the objective of restoring the area to its former glory, while secretly looking for Herr Niedermayer's body. An army excavator was painted yellow, and some dump trucks were brought in, and hundreds of lorry loads of rubbish were removed from the site. The people cleaning the site were undercover police officers, and they spent 4 weeks cleaning out the area. They all carried weapons under their jackets in case the IRA decided to attack. Eventually, the area was cleaned out, and then the search for the body could begin. They knew he was buried in a shallow grave somewhere in this glen. The search was long and took a number of weeks, but eventually they located a pair of trousers, of which there were bones inside. They had found the body of Herr Niedermayer. He had been buried face down in a shallow grave, like Disciple said, and he was still wearing the slippers he had on the night he disappeared. Once his body was discovered, the whole truth started to come out. The autopsy revealed that Herr Niedermayer had two severe indentations on his skull, which were consistent with being hit in the head with the butt of a gun. Then, armed with the accurate information from Disciple, two men were arrested, John Bradley and Eugene McManus. Upon being interviewed, the two men explained what happened. Herr Niedermayer was kidnapped and brought to a house, where the IRA told the homeowner to leave and come back in a number of days. After 3 days, and growing more and more agitated, Herr Niedermayer asked to be taken to the toilet, where he made an attempt to escape, shouting out one of the windows of the house and running for the stairs. 4 men dragged him back to his room, and it was here that he was hit with the butt of the gun, before having his head pressed against a mattress. It's unclear if it was the blow to the head or the suffocation on the mattress, but within a few minutes, Herr Niedermayer was dead. He was then brought to Colin Glen, where he was buried. A prayer was said over his body by the 4 men as he was being buried. In court, the men accepted a guilty plea deal, and Bradley was sentenced to 20 years imprisonment for his role in the killing, and McManus was sentenced to 5 years. But what should be the end of this tragic story is actually just the beginning. It's at this point I have to mention what will become a major source for the rest of this episode. A radio documentary produced by Joe Duffy and Kieran Cassidy called A Knock on the Door. It provides some excellent insights and interviews with the granddaughters of Herr Niedermayer. After Herr Niedermayer's body was discovered, Ingeborg wrote a thank you note to a local newspaper. It read, quote, "In the past few days, the sad story of my husband Thomas has been finally and completely told. You were kind enough to mention my family and I in your editorial on Tuesday evening. These words were of great consolation to me and my daughters. You were right. The past 7 years have not been happy ones. But now we feel that the past is behind us, and my daughter Renata and I would like to thank the Irish people for supporting us during these years. Through your kindness and understanding, we were able to remain among you and make a life for ourselves. In no way do we hold the Irish people responsible for anything that happened. My family was caught up in events that were beyond our control and theirs. Mrs. Ingeborg Niedermayer." There's also a recording of Renata speaking shortly after the discovery of her father's body.
"My father was found. It all happened very, very fast. I was just telephoned one morning at work by the police saying that could I please come to the station. They weren't going to tell me what it was over the phone. A fairly good idea. So I arrived down and they were very kind. They explained what the situation was to me. And I waited around until it was confirmed that it was my father's body that had been found. And curiously enough, actually, as a crow flies, it was about a mile from our house, and I had passed the spot many, many, many times. And it was rather ironic to think he'd been there all the time. And it was, in fact, under a rubbish tip, which I was quite offended at. I mean, they could have chosen somewhere else that wasn't as gory as that. My mother was relieved whenever she heard. She was very distressed, I think, at where he was found again, under a rubbish tip in a very shallow grave. It did disturb her. But she was very, very relieved that he'd been found. We were called again to the police station to identify bits of clothing, which we in due course did. And then I think it was a few days after that my father's funeral took place. It happened very, very quickly, and I don't think any of us really had time to think. What with within days of the body being found, there were funeral arrangements to make. I mean, after 7 years, you don't think of things like that. So in due time, he was buried, and as my father's coffin was being lowered into the grave, she took a rose from a wreath and threw it under the coffin. And she was in a complete and absolute daze at that stage. It took a great deal out of her. I left early, as I say, immediately after that. And a friend drove me home. And then I went home to my own cottage. And I'm fine. 2 days after that, I was, at least immediately after that, I did all the things I usually have to. But it was 2 days after that, for the life of me, I couldn't get up. It seemed as though I didn't have a bit of strength in me, so I stayed in bed all day.
Soon after the discovery of Herr Niedermeyer's body, Ingeborg returned to Germany, which was probably a completely new country to her by now, as her native Prussia had been absorbed into Poland and Russia. But she never quite got over the death of her husband, and the relationship between Ingeborg, Renata, and Gabriella was never the same. Her granddaughter, Rachel, explained that Ingeborg blamed herself for not being there with her daughters on that night, even though her presence probably would have made very little difference. Ingeborg went on to live in Germany for 10 years and then returned to Ireland in 1990. She then booked herself into a hotel in the Irish seaside town of Greystones. Then, on the 10-year anniversary of her husband's funeral and 17 years since her husband's disappearance, Ingeborg walked into the ocean and drowned herself. Her body was discovered a few hours later by a passerby. Tabloid newspaper The Sun reported on her death saying, 62-year-old Ingeborg Niedermeyer did not commit suicide. She was murdered by the IRA, as surely as if they had put a gun to her head and shot her at point-blank range. Gabriella was on holidays with her two young daughters at the time. She had to fly back to Ireland to identify the body and organised the death certificate and funeral. She was the only one to attend her mother's funeral, even though the Niedermeyer name had been known all over Ireland and the UK just a few years previously. Renata also carried guilt and blame from that night, which never left her, as she was the one who opened the door to the two men. After the death of Herr Niedermeyer, the two daughters grew apart. Gabriella had already moved away, and soon when Renata was old enough, she left Northern Ireland and moved to Surrey in England. While there, she had a number of exotic animals, including owls, snakes, and either a leopard or a tiger. She then moved to South Africa, but was unable to find a home for the animals, so she released them into the English countryside and moved away. She didn't marry, and she didn't have any children. Shortly after the death of Ingeborg, Renata took her own life in South Africa. Gabriella got married at 19 and married Robin, who was a member of the Royal Air Force, at a secret ceremony in England. It was secret because she was afraid that the IRA may try and attack her wedding. She had two children with Robin, Rachel and Tanya, and lived in England with her family. They have very fond memories of their mother, but say she was haunted by the fact that she was the sole surviving member of her family. In 1994, Gabriella was turning 40 and had fallen into a severe depression. Her husband and daughters tried to help her through the depression, but in the end, it took hold and she attempted suicide. She was unsuccessful in the initial attempt, but then 2 weeks later, she succeeded. Rachel remembers her mother saying to her shortly before she died, "My family don't live beyond 40. The final tragedy in this upsetting tale ends with Gabriella's husband, Robin. He had tried to move on past the death of his wife, but found it impossible to cope without her. According to his daughter, he couldn't understand how anyone could make the decision to take their own life, and he couldn't make peace with the loss of his wife. In 1999, he fell into a deep depression and started having suicidal thoughts. He had been telling Tanya for 6 months previous that he had been planning to take his own life, and eventually he did. He passed away 5 years after Gabriella. As of writing, Tanya and Rachel are living in the United Kingdom and Australia, and have families of their own. The fallout from the killing of Thomas Niedermeyer caused a ripple that would tear families apart for generations. His death would lead to 4 other members of his family losing their lives. During the period in history known as the Troubles, the exact figure is debatable, but approximately 3,532 people lost their lives. You often hear about the figures and the deaths and statistics, but many don't understand the ripple effect that exists and how the grief and trauma that occurred can pass down through generations. Today, suicide rates in Northern Ireland are the highest in the UK and Ireland, as the country is still in a state of recovery from the after effects of the Troubles, and there is still a lot of healing to do. That's it for this episode. If you've been affected by anything I've spoken about, please don't be afraid to reach out to those close to you who love you, or to one of the many societies who are there to help. I'll list some in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.